these are some, one is a package was left out on page 63. So replace that page number 63, and also if you'll replace page number 26 in the prioritized reductions.
I've got a page 26 and just replace what's
replace
there.
It. Yes, sir. And the same with page number 63. Senator, we have an extra. You also have at your place a copy of the presentation that the department will be going over today, the slideshow presentation. That's in a slideshow format, and the director of the Department of Water Resources, Phil Ward, is here.
Mr. Ward.
Thank you, sir. We're ready if you are.
Good face, different capacity.
That's right. That's right. Last time I was here with you in the director's capacity, it was with a different spot.
So we're going to have to
maybe
move this back.
Okay. Maybe we can bring that up like that. So for the record, Mr. Chair and members, my name is Phil Ward. I'm the director of the Oregon Water Resources Department. I'm pleased to have the opportunity to spend today and Monday with you, giving you that overview for the agency's budget that we've been asked to provide in this little two-day time slot. So the first thing that I wanted to do with you is give you a brief outline, and my apologies to Senator Shields. This may be tough to see from that spot. Give you a brief outline of what we're going to be talking about over the next little bit. We hope to provide you a description of our agency's mission and goals, a brief perspective on water law and how we administer that here in the state of Oregon. We're, of course, hopeful of being able to highlight for you the importance and significance of our agency during this time, the next couple days together. We will lay out for you the results of our program prioritization, as you've asked for, and our performance measures, and along with our official performance measures, we hope to talk a little bit about some other practical outcomes that relate to those measures. And then finally, we plan to lay out for you again, as you've requested, the reductions and adjustments in the governor's budget, and the additional 10% reduction package according to LFO instructions. So the material we're going to talk through today is in tabs 1 through 4 of this little blue book.
Members of the committee, those books are delivered to you a week ago, as is the practice with this committee. We'll be delivering you the materials a week ahead of time so that you can look over them before the meeting. So you can prepare any questions if you'd like. If you don't have your copy, we can certainly have someone
There's
bring down one.
There's an extra here, Senator Shields, if that would be helpful to you.
I might have my staff bring it down anyway.
And then what we're really, as Mr. Siebert mentioned earlier, what we're really going to be working through is this handout today. So these are the slides you're going to see. Kind of the overarching message that I think we hope to communicate in the next couple sessions with you is that the agency has taken some significant but manageable reductions in the governor's budget, that we've ranked our programs according to your instructions, but we're going to be making the point a couple times during this presentation that the Water Resources Department programs are inextricably linked. However you say that, they're linked. They're integrated.
Hooked together.
They're hooked together. Thank you, Senator. And so that while we have ranked those, it's very difficult for us to separate and pull programs apart because of that linkage. Additionally, it's, of course, our view that the agency is essential both to the economic health and the environmental health of the state of Oregon, that there's an economic and environmental component to what we do. And then the last thing I'd like to mention, kind of in terms of an overarching message, is that there is no federal counterpart to what the Oregon Water Resources Department does. And frankly, members, we don't want one. We don't want the federal government in the water quantity management business in the state of Oregon.
You could say that with a little more passion, yeah. You know, like something like,
Amen! Hallelujah!
Drop the gavel.
I wanted him to know how he felt, excuse me.
We enjoy that concept, too, because we only have to come to one person, one agency.
That's right.
Who's under the control, who we work with.
And that can be good and bad for the agency, Mr. Scheer. Because there's nowhere else we can turn, that's for sure. We're the buck stops with us on this issue. So we're the water quantity people in the state of Oregon. And our agency has two what we consider co-equal goals. And both of these goals are established statutorily, pretty clearly in our statutory portfolio. We need to make sure that we're addressing Oregon's water supply needs. So getting water to the people that need it for the legitimate and legal uses in the state of Oregon. Additionally, co-equal with that is the goal to restore and protect Oregon's stream flow and watersheds. And again, we have a significant statutory portfolio in both these areas.
At some point, can you address the long-range or future supply? Where are we looking? Do we have an ongoing program that identifies needs of cities for future domestic water supplies? I don't know where we are, but sometime, you know, in the process here.
Mr. Chair, we do plan to cover that as part of our presentation, so I think we'll get there and be able to spend the time you'd like on that. There are several core functions or strategies that are key to what this agency does. One, statutorily, we're required to protect existing and senior water right users. So that's a key part of what we do on a daily basis. As the chair just articulated, it's important, we believe, and part of our statutory charge to facilitate water supply solutions. Thirdly, we think it's real important that we continue to expand our knowledge of what the water resource looks like in the state of Oregon, particularly the amount of that resource that's under the ground. That's the part we know the least about, of course. Again, part of our charge is to facilitate voluntary stream flow restoration, and we believe we've got some good success stories to show you in that regard over the next couple days. And then lastly, it's amazing to me how many people are interested in the data that this agency produces. And again, for people to do the kind of business that they need to do around the state, they need to access water resource data, and that's part of our core function. Mr. Chair and members, here's how we're organized. We have five divisions. Our technical services division, which these are our primary science types in the agency. I'd like to note that the information management division, the computer folks in this agency, are actually a part of our technical services division. We don't consider our computer functions an administrative function because they are so tied to the success of our programs. And frankly, one of the ways that we've dealt with reduced staff in recent years is through technology. So we'll talk about that more later. Our public safety program and our surface and groundwater scientific staff are located there in the technical services division, and that's administered by Barry Norris, who's in the room today. Our water rights program and the adjudications program, these are the folks that you go to if you would like to secure a new water right. And they're also the folks that administer the, I don't know whether it's famous or infamous, Klamath adjudication process. And so we'll talk a little bit with you all about that during this time. They also handle our hydroelectric program responsibilities. The field services division is our largest division. These are the water masters that are out around the state. And they're the folks that distribute water according to priority dates on water rights certificates. And about 63 folks in that division, about 20 of those our water masters, and then we have 16, a little over 16 assistant water masters that are funded by the counties. So these are our on-the-ground people. They also do a lot of collection, stream flow data collection, that type of thing. We have a little over 10 people in our administrative division, and then the director's office. And the director's office basically handles all the legal coordination that the agency is responsible for. We have a fairly significant budget with the Attorney General's office that rests all as a part of the director's office portfolio, and of course all the other things that you see there, part of what we do. So a little, just quickly, want to give you just a quick idea of our field divisions. You can see here the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 divisions, and there are actually 19 field offices in this agency around the state. Some of them are pretty teeny. We've got a field office in Condon. Got a field office in Coquille, Oregon City, Klamath Falls. Got offices Lakeview, Tillamook. So we've got offices around the state where our water masters reside. I think most of you are familiar with the Water Resources Commission. And the rulemaking responsibility in this agency is vested in the Oregon Water Resources Commission. Appointed by the governor, confirmed by the Senate, serve 4-year terms, and are placed geographically. Currently we have, as you can see, a couple key vacancies, and we understand the governor's office is working on a slate of candidates for the Senate to nominate for Senate consideration in the not-too-distant future, and that would be great because we can't afford for a commissioner to be sick at meeting time right now. In fact, our last meeting, we had to have two commissioners connected by phone for our action items. There are no questions there. I wanted to talk just a little bit historically about what the agency does and how it got there. This agency has roots, as you can imagine, tracing back to the early history of Oregon. Before 1909, water claims were treated much like mining claims in this state. You staked your claim, and you went to the county court and registered it. In 1909, the legislature chose to create Oregon's first water code. And that code established the system that we currently operate under today. And really, that early code, the system that we currently use, is built on that foundation. Essentially, the doctrine of prior appropriation, first in time, first in right. So if I was here before you and registered my claim, I have a senior right to use water. In 1955, the Oregon legislature actually adopted the State Groundwater Act. And so groundwater is like surface water in Oregon, and we provide the same kind of water right permit system for the use of groundwater. That's not true in all western states. For example, in California, amazingly, the state does not regulate or administer any kind of groundwater system. And so the counties actually have the authority to do that in California, but it's my understanding that not many counties have actually undertaken that endeavor. So groundwater is pretty different, Mr. Chair.
I have a question, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just curious because I've worked with the water boards in California. Have we ever thought about going to a similar system where it's delegated out regional water boards? I mean, has that ever been analyzed here as an option?
Mr. Chair, Representative, you know, California does quite a few things on that county or regional basis. I know that they have regional agricultural commissioners in each county that have certain authorities.
By watershed level, I mean, is another, because we all know, you know, that's one option, is looking and having watershed regional boards like that.
I'm not sure we've really looked hard at that here in Oregon. Certainly would be something we could do. I think ultimately we might see cost increases in terms of what it took to administer programs if we added that layer.
Thank you.
Senator Shields?
Just a quick question. When you were saying that, you know, the groundwater right, they don't do that in California. I was at a meeting the Legislative Governance Council for the Columbia River, and we were looking at what was going on in eastern Washington, and they have such a huge aquifer. It's easy to conceive that it goes across state lines, so is it possible that California could be
sucking our water up?
Appropriating water from our groundwater reservoir. Is there any conflict about that?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I think it's safe to say that California does get some of our water now and again. And, in fact, in the Klamath Basin, they drilled, following the crisis of 2001, six or eight, Barry? Seven wells right along the state line.
Oh, good.
that we believe draw significantly from water that actually resides under the state of Oregon. And that said...
like a lawsuit to me.
We did have some situations last summer where it was our view that some of those wells were interfering with wells on the Oregon side. And so we actually worked with the irrigation district manager down there, that's the steward of those wells, the administrator of that program, and they shut off a couple of the offending wells for a period of time. But certainly, states share aquifers. That's very true. In 1975, the legislature created something called the Water Policy Review Board, which was responsible for planning and overall water resource policy in the state of Oregon. That was separate from the state engineer's office, which was the technical arm of the water resource endeavor here in Oregon. That was merged in 75, and eventually, and that's what created, actually, the Water Resources Department. So as an actual department, we're fairly young. And then in 1985, the Water Policy Review Board was turned into the Water Resources Commission by the Oregon legislature. And so that's the structure we have today. Just a few words in terms of the basic principles of Oregon water law. Oregon law establishes the public ownership of the surface and groundwaters of the state and requires that water be managed by the Oregon Water Resources Department. And again, there are several components that were established in the 1909 water code that we operate under today. One, if you have a water right, you have to use it beneficially. You have to use it for a legitimate purpose, and you have to use it without waste. That's longstanding Oregon law. Secondly, it's a priority-based system. First in time, first in right, as we already discussed. Thirdly, and an important piece of Oregon law here is the appurtenancy component, that the water right is attached to the land. So if you sell the land, the water right goes with the land. It does not stay with you. And lastly, you need to retain that water right, you have to use it at least once beneficially in every 5 years. Here are the elements of a water right. Every water right will identify a source. Is it groundwater? Is it surface water? Where's it located? The source of the water. Every water right will identify a type of use. What's the beneficial use of the water for which this right has been established? Thirdly, a point of diversion or appropriation is identified in the water rights. Where's the water taken from? You've taken it from a well. Where's that well located? You've taken it from a stream. Where's that at? And then the place of use, which generally is close to the place of diversion or appropriation, but not always, where the water is applied. So the permit system, for those of us that have water rights, we've gone through, or one of our forebears has gone through this process. They've applied for a water right. When they apply, they receive a priority date. So your priority date is based on when you apply, not when the final certificate is given. Following the application, the department reviews that and ultimately, if it meets the criteria, issues a permit. Then you have the opportunity to prove up on that permit. If you prove up on the permit, you use the water beneficially and according to the requirements of the permit. Ultimately, the final piece of the equation is that you get a certificate. And that, of course, is a coveted document if you own property in this state. The certificate can be modified. And so oftentimes, and some of the business we do most today relates to modifications of the permit in terms of something we call a transfer. So if I have a certificate for water right on a farm in at such and such a location and I want to move it down the road, that is possible to do. The department will do an analysis of whether that would cause injury to any other water rights. And essentially, the short version is, if it doesn't, individuals are able to transfer where that water right is used. And obviously, if there's non-use...
Can they do that in multiples? I mean, say you have the big ranch, you move it over here for a while, and then you move it back again?
I believe you can move. You can transfer as long as you're working off a certificate. Of course, the process is not it's neither quick nor simple. So people don't do a lot of quick transfers. But I believe yes, that's true. Once you move it, you establish that use.
Thank you, and Senator Shields, that's a great question because as an irrigator for many years. Having the ability.
And all this time I thought he was just an irritator.
Yeah.
Go ahead. When am I going to stop opening myself up?
I'll tell you. Well, anyway. It's so good to be able to rotate your crops and to be able to move water from one field to the other. Now, sometimes you may swap fields with your neighbor because they're growing a crop that they can't grow again. For a couple of years, like canola, you can only grow about 1 year out of every four in the same spot because it gets diseases and those kinds of things. So you need to be able to swap the water around effectively. And I have to say that it's gotten a lot better. It's really gotten to be a pretty decent way of doing it now in terms of working with water resources, in terms of making the transfers. It used to be, and I don't even want to tell you what my language and thoughts used to be like when I used to talk to them about doing this many years ago, but it is a really important component in maintaining a proper agricultural mix in any given area. And it's one area that we can always improve on, but it really is an important piece of this whole puzzle.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair and Senator Shields, I think what Representative Krupp very clearly articulates there is something I failed to mention in answering your question initially, is the temporary transfer process, which is much less involved than a permanent formal transfer. And so that's a process that folks do use pretty effectively that we've implemented to be able to move water around more quickly.
It's very flexible, the temporary transfer. Great program.
Another type of water right that bears some discussion in this process is the in-stream water right process. And Oregon law establishes or provides for in-stream water rights for essentially three purposes. Recreation, and the Parks and Recreation Department can actually apply for in-stream water rights for those purposes. Pollution control, and the Department of Environmental Quality is articulated statutorily as the group that can apply for those type of in-stream water rights, and then for fish and wildlife purposes through ODF&W. So those rights are ultimately, if they are established, are held in trust by the Water Resources Department, and those came about, that's a fairly young program. The in-stream water right law was established in 1987. Here's where you find existing in-stream water rights in the state of Oregon. So you can see a fairly good geographic distribution. There are over 1,400 in-stream water rights currently established in the state of Oregon. Well, we wanted to spend a little time with you, and certainly it was a part of the instructions, but we wanted to make sure we didn't neglect talking about what we view as the importance of what this agency does to Oregonians.
Poor Oregonians.
Yes.
Nice. Representative. Four, not two.
Just depends on which side you're
on. There may be some people here that think you do it to them. It feels like they think you do it for them.
Not me, my constituents.
Sorry, Phil.
No, that was this. Thank you for that, Representative. That was good.
Is that what we call a Freudian slip?
We're going to keep him on his toes.
Yeah. We are.
That reminds me of the beginning of my professional career as a high school teacher and the students that took a great delight in finding my misspellings on the chalkboard.
That was before spell check, right?
That was way before spell check, yes. You know, this the things that this agency does for Oregonians... there's, as we mentioned earlier, this is one of really a fundamental function of government in the West. We all know Mark Twain's old adage, the motto in your committee, representative: waters for, or whiskey's for drinking, waters for fighting. Certainly, when we established the water code in 1909 in this state, it was to prevent that. We still fight over water today. We just rather than using guns, we use attorneys now. But there's still a lot of dispute.
You call them hired guns,
yeah.
Mr. Chair.
Do we have Senator Burdick to thank for this? Or
these people got a sugar high. They've been eating all week.
I know. Just high, been back
to
the trough eating.
All right, guys. It's Thursday. That's what it is.
But the other thing I'd like to just mention under this line is that, again, there is no federal component for what we do. We can't back up to EPA to cover it if the state of Oregon chooses not to. And again, to me, that's one reason what we do is so important to Oregonians. No federal counterpart. So we need to provide certainty for the people who have rights to use water because their businesses and livelihoods depend upon it. If we don't find ways to effectively administer the water rights program in Oregon, we can impede significantly, and I imagine we could bring people in who felt they've had their economic opportunities impeded because of the water rights program. But we can impede economic activity in this state if we don't administer this program effectively. We can also impede environmental opportunities in this state. Again, part of our responsibility is that stewardship piece of the water equation. And it's extremely important, in my view, to both the economy and environment in this state that we have an effective water resources program. The chair mentioned earlier long-term water supply, and again, that we'll talk about that a little more in a couple spots, but we need to make sure that we're ensuring a sustainable long-term supply. In Senator Nelson's neighborhood, we have seen declines in the groundwater levels of over 500 feet in the last 25 years. It's a significant issue because there's a tremendous economy built in that region on the use of the water resource. It's interesting to me that in that Columbia Basin, much of the soil in that area is what we would consider class 5 bad soil, except when you add water to it and it moves to class 1 or class 2. And so we need to make sure, as the chief water management agency in the state, that we're ensuring a sustainable and long-term supply. There are public safety aspects to what we do. The dam safety program for the state of Oregon rests with our agency. And we actively, on the ground, are inspecting dams. We're reviewing all the plans for dams constructed in Oregon. We're involved with some of that right now. We need to make sure the dams are constructed safely. Our water supply wells have an extremely important public safety component. We don't want things happening to that groundwater aquifer that would contaminate it. And so we need to make sure wells are constructed in a manner that doesn't allow contaminants from the surface to get into the groundwater aquifer. We're very active there.
Mr. Chair, I have a question about dams. I have a dam question. It's coming kind of flying around here. I'm just curious, what is there jurisdictional overlap between USGS and Dogami on that issue? I mean, do you have jurisdiction over all dams? Is there a threshold on certain dams? Is it just push-up dams? I'm just curious, and because, you know, we often have multiple agencies working on this issue, or do you rely on USGS for assistance on, you know, federal dams? I'm just curious.
Mr. Chair, if I might, Representative, to accurately answer your question, if I could have Barry Norris, who runs that program, join us.
You guys were in front of us for 3 hours yesterday, so they're like, don't ask me any more questions.
Mr. Chair, I'm Barry Norris, Manager of Technical Service Division at Water Resources Department. Mr. Chair, Representative Dingfelder, first, USGS doesn't do the inspection. The Corps of the federal agencies like the Corps of Engineers, the Bureau of Reclamation, the FERC structures that have hydroelectric licenses on the federal level, they take a look at the dams that they have jurisdiction over, and they're responsible for the dam safety issues. Oregon statutes allow that all dams over 9.2 acre feet and 10 feet in height, those two things, if the dam exceeds 10 feet, is 10 feet or more in height or 9.2 acre feet or more, then they're under jurisdiction of the Oregon Dam Safety Program. Our program is pretty small, but it works closely with the federal agencies, and it takes a back seat to the federal agencies that have jurisdiction over their dams, so that we might accompany them on an inspection, or we might just simply communicate with them about their dams. The rest of the dams that exceed those size limits in Oregon are solely under the jurisdiction. Nobody else is looking at them unless, you know, somebody asks a consultant to go out and look. We might ask that the owner have a consultant go out and look, but that's how the jurisdictional lines run.
So just a quick follow-up. So you guys have inspectors, you have geologists or whatever that you employ to go out and do periodic inspections, or is it only in conjunction with the water right? I'm just curious because I thought Dogami did this, so this is really educational for me.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dingfelder, no, Dogami is not involved in that, although they do sit on the HART Committee for Hydroelectric and advise on seismic issues. But the dam safety component, we look at the hydrology, we look at the seismic stability, we look at all types of stability, the size of the spillway, the whole structure is under our jurisdiction. We have one full-time person that works on that. It's an engineer, geotechnical engineer, and I'm a geotechnical engineer. We both look at the special inspections, and we review all the plans and specs for new construction, for modifications, and so on. And then we use our field crews in the region offices, the water masters and their assistants, who do routine inspections to look at for signs of instability.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So a pretty efficient program that utilizes existing resources, but we do have the two engineers in the agency.
Microphone's shadow.
Yeah, move your microphone, not
Thank
in your picture.
Thank you.
Oh, look at that. You can make little animals move.
Yeah.
Okay. Trying to remember where I was here. Okay, public safety. Let's go to water resource data, and I do want to just mention briefly that we have a tremendous amount of people that are interested in our data, and so we've had to learn to manage that data in a way that makes it accessible to folks that need it. One example of a customer group there is the real estate industry. They are always very interested in what the status of water rights are on properties that they have listed. Folks that are looking to make real estate transactions. Access our data regularly. So that's just one example of a public that uses our data on really more than a daily basis. So who are the customers of the Water Resources Department? Well, it would be our view, and I think legitimately, that everybody in Oregon is affected by what we do. You can see kind of a laundry list of customers there along that line, but certainly farmers are our customers. State and federal agencies, public interest groups who have an interest in the fish and wildlife resource are our customers. We interface with all these folks all the time. There's a lot of interest from the folks on this list in terms of what we do as an agency. Oregon has over 100,000 miles of streams in this state, 85,000 water rights, about 133,000 surface water diversions, so places at the surface where we take water, 230,000 wells, and over 16,000 reservoirs. That's why we have so many customers, I guess. Just quickly, to give you a snapshot, and I know as we move into the other phases of the budget, but a snapshot of our budget by source, we're largely a general fund agency. The governor's recommended budget for this biennium, about $19.5 million. Other funds, fees, and contracts, a little over $8 million. Federal funds down there at the bottom, we have over $1 million of federal funds. And that the other small slice, non-limited debt service, relates to a program we'll talk about a little bit later, the Water Development Loan Program, a very small piece of other fund there. We've been asked to identify for you some of the key issues that we that are facing the agency, and we believe are facing the state of Oregon as a whole in terms of the water resource. Certainly, increasing workload with the decreasing resources. We'd like to give you here, I think, before I go through that list, just a general idea of some of the budgetary environmental issues we're facing, and we'll get into this in greater detail in phase two. But increasing workload with decreasing resources, let's go to our next slide. You can see that the height of the employee numbers at the Oregon Water Resources Department was the late 90s, where we had over 160 employees in our agency. The governor's recommended budget brings us down to 136 for the 05-07 biennium. So that's certainly the lowest level in quite a significant period of time. Interestingly enough, we've had about a 30% increase in water rights to administer in the last decade with about 15% less staff. Other interesting components, the number of wells are increasing by about 6,000 a year in the state. And we issue 400 to 500 new water rights for surface water diversions a year. And we take an average of about 9 to 12,000 regulatory actions to protect existing water rights per year.
At what point does the creation of 6,000 new wells per year run headlong into what you just said about protecting existing water rights? I mean, excuse me, I suppose I'm asking philosophical questions, but it seems you can't keep doing that forever.
Mr. Chair, Senator, no, that's an excellent question. And I think the majority of the wells, and I'll just glance back at Barry on this, the majority of these wells are going to be what we call exempt wells of the 6,000. The majority of the wells drilled every year in the state, you don't have to have our permission to drill. So an exempt well would be one for domestic use. So for your house and a half acre of lawn and garden, you can essentially go out and drill a well. You have to send us notification. You have to send us a start, what's called a start card, that you're drilling that well. And ultimately, that well becomes that that's a water right to that well.
Quick follow up on that: is there an MGD threshold on that, or it's purely for domestic use or size of the?
For domestic use, up to 15,000 gallons a day, if my recollection's correct. And not to exceed a half acre of lawn and garden. Is that?
Including that classification, monitoring wells.
Okay. So, and Mr. Norris reminds me that includes monitoring wells, so wells that are used to monitor groundwater statuses there.
Out of the 6,000, you're saying?
That's going to be the majority, the vast majority of that 6,000.
Okay.
Oh, no, the monitoring wells, that classification including both those, exempt domestic wells and monitoring, is going to be the vast majority of the 6,000.
And the 15,000 gallon per day and a half acre is what defines domestic?
Yes.
Okay.
Now, to answer the second part of your question, Senator, does that sometimes run in to the being able to manage for a sustainable long-term supply? I think the short answer to that is yes. And certainly we've seen in Senator Nelson's area, again, in the I'm sorry to pick on your neighborhood, Senator, but the Umatilla Basin, where there's been quite a debate recently about the exempt well use, putting new exempt wells in these critical groundwater areas that have been established there. And so there is quite a local debate about that issue.
A quick follow-up to that is, and we should talk about this later, and maybe we need to have more talk in the Water Committee, but is that based, I mean, are you guys, the concern, and I know where Senator Shields going, as far as the cumulative effects, the drawdown on the aquifer, if you guys are doing modeling and tracking all the wells that are going in there to make sure that they're not having, you know, a cumulative impact on the aquifer, I don't know the answer, so I'd be curious to know. And you have that now, or you can come back and tell me.
Mr. Chair, just first a comparison, we think 15,000 gallons of water sounds like a lot of water, but an acre foot of water, which would be 200 feet by 200 feet, is 325,000 gallons of water. I mean, the issue in our part of the country is the fact that our guys look out at the Columbia River and they see 200 million acre feet of water running by and they can't use any. But we can solve our groundwater problem potentially with a very little, with less than 0.5% or 0.1% out of the Columbia River.
So are you guys, do you do modeling so when you see a start card come up and you go, well, you know, this is, I mean, is it only for the critical groundwater areas, or are you doing modeling all over the state so you can see what the cumulative impacts are?
We're certainly attempting, Mr. Chair and Representative, we're certainly attempting to learn all we can about the water resource around the state. We've conducted groundwater studies in the Willamette Basin, and we have one that's just finishing up in the Klamath now. In the Deschutes Basin, we did a significant study that frankly led to some significant action on our parts there. We're hoping to initiate one in the Umatilla Basin now. So I think the short answer is, yes, we're attempting to track those things carefully as funds allow. We can, and we'd be happy in the Water Committee to provide. I know we didn't get to some of that yesterday, and we could come back and provide some of that when you want it. So how are we addressing this issue, less staff, bigger workload? And certainly when you have a water supply that's pretty much fully appropriated on a surface water basis around the state, it requires more management. It takes more management work to make sure that the senior rights are getting their water. How do you deal with it? The way that we've used recently, and frankly, coming over here to this agency, I have been very favorably impressed with the information technology program here. It's sophisticated, it's user-friendly, and it's committed to making the programs more effective. And so that is how we have begun to address, that's how we've really reached in, and we begin to automate much of our work using technology. People can access data on their own through the web, and we've been mapping things digitally, as the representative was just talking about, to provide the information that we need to make decisions. Additionally, we've been working, especially recently, to streamline our processes. As you can imagine, any bureaucracy has lots of bureaucratic processes. Almost our entire legislative package this time, just half a dozen bills, but five of the six of those, I believe, are directly related to trying to streamline our regulatory processes in ways that work for our customers and don't compromise the protection of the resource. So we have several little bills in to do that. The other thing I just would mention quickly while we're looking at this slide is an action that you all took last legislative session. You put in place a program that we call the Reimbursement Authority Program, which allows us to work with applicants who would like to expedite their application by allowing them to pay the cost of us hiring a contractor to do some of the nuts and bolts work. This program has actually worked real effectively, and I'll touch on it again later in the presentation. So how do we satisfy new demands in a largely appropriated system? This is stream flow, surface water, and the beige areas are where there is no surface water available in August for further appropriation. So you can see the vast majority of the state, with the exception of the Willamette Basin, is fully appropriated in terms of surface water. So how do we deal with that? We use a couple tools for that. One is an area we talked about briefly earlier, transfers. We move water around, and people are using that effectively as a way to get water to places where they haven't had it before. Sometimes you'll find folks working out agreements with other folks to transfer their water right to them. Another area we have already mentioned briefly is the Deschutes Groundwater Mitigation Program. In Deschutes County and the Deschutes Basin, we found through an intensive groundwater study that the groundwater and the surface water is directly linked. The surface water is fully appropriated in the Deschutes Basin. And because it's directly linked with the groundwater, that means when you withdraw new groundwater, you're impacting the surface water. And so we've put together a mitigation program to keep economic development going in that basin, which needs it, where folks can actually buy mitigation credits to allow them to develop where they would not have been able to otherwise. And certainly, I think a priority for us and something we're beginning to work more and more on is storing water in the winter in perhaps more creative ways than we've done it in the past. One of those ways, and again, we talked about this yesterday with your committee representative, is putting that water back in the ground in the wintertime. And there are at least a half a dozen municipalities here in Oregon that are experimenting under a limited license with us at wintertime aquifer storage and recharge. So they're taking high-flow water in the winter. The city of Salem is actually treating that water and then putting it in the aquifer so they can use it from their wells in the summer seasons. Again, at least half a dozen, maybe closer to eight or nine cities experimenting with this around the state. We hope to do more of it. And of course, we're attempting to promote conservation and allowing folks to allocate conserved water to new uses.
This water that's being recharging aquifers, it's been treated?
Mr. Chair, one of the limiting factors for us to put water back in the ground that's essentially surface water. Let's say my well was going dry. I live near the Willamette River, and I wanted to put some of that high flow in the Willamette back in my well in the winter so I could use it in the summer. I would have to ensure that water essentially met safe drinking water standards to put it back in the aquifer. You can't degrade the aquifer. The EQ is very much involved with that issue. And for us to be able to issue a permit to do that, the program has to have the approval of the Department of Environmental Quality. I thought you might want to hear just a second on current water conditions. The short answer in terms of what our water forecasting looks like for this summer is not very good.
Bleak,
that's very true. Statewide, we're averaging about 69% of normal right now. That's actually more than I would have guessed. Not shaping up very good, as the representative identified. So, again, the question that I would immediately ask is, well, Water Resources Department, what are you doing about that situation? And we do have a few tools in times of drought that we, in all probability, we may get to exercise this year. If you look all the way to the right, that's the stream flow forecast for this summer based on what we've received so far in terms of precipitation, but that's assuming a normal precipitation level the rest of the year, and that's anybody's guess whether we're going to get that or not. So if we end up in a drought, obviously the governor has a drought council on which we serve that works to address these things. We have a few tools if a drought is declared to use. In 2001 in Klamath County, we issued a bunch of emergency use permits for groundwater. Now, I know there are folks that are concerned about the use of that emergency permit authority, but that is something that we have used pretty significantly in times of extreme drought. We've folks who had surface water rights, we've issued them a permit to go to groundwater during the period of drought. And that's on the books. And certainly, as Representative Krupp talked about earlier, we can transfer water. Temporary drought transfers are an expedited transfer process that we can use during times of drought to move water around as well. Klamath adjudication. Almost everywhere I go, I'm asked how the Klamath adjudication is coming in. Are we ever going to finish the adjudication of the Klamath Basin? In fact, several of you have asked me that question this week.
How about in our lifetime?
In our lifetime. So here's the short story on that. There were about 729, well, there were exactly 729 claims for water made in the Klamath Basin when we started this adjudication many, many years ago. There were over 5,600 contests or disputes to those 729 claims. And so the business we've been about the last decade is resolving those contests. So as of this January, we had resolved 86% of all the contests. You're contesting my claim, and we've resolved over 65% of the actual claims. We have hearings scheduled for all the remaining claims, and those are to be completed, if we follow the schedule, by the end of 2007.
So are those claims that you have remaining that have been there a long time, have they been worked on, and are they some of the more difficult ones?
Mr. Chair, sadly enough, I think you're right on point there. Some of the most difficult issues remain in the adjudication. The tribal water rights issue, the contest between the upper basin irrigators and the project irrigators. And so the good news in that regard is a former member of your body, Senator Steve Harper, has actually been leading settlement discussions. We've been supporting him. We've been his technical support in that for the last 6, maybe 8 months, where he has the last major claimants and the folks with the last major contests talking with each other on a regular basis in an attempt to resolve some of the most significant claims. So that's the good news. But you're very correct in saying that you get the low-hanging fruit first, and the tough stuff that you need a ladder for is still up there. And Senator Harper's really, I can't say enough for how important his efforts have been in the last year down there.
Yeah, I lived down there for 3 years and still connected with several tribal members down there and have communication with them. How do you assess their treatment in all of this?
Mr. Chair, Senator, in my experience, the tribal members are very effective in their participation in this process. They have excellent legal counsel that knows a lot about water law that's staffing them in their efforts. The tribal chairman, Alan Foreman, who actually Alan and I worked together, he was a supervising brand inspector at the Oregon Department of Agriculture for a dozen years out of Hermiston. But Alan has an excellent understanding of water law and tribal claims and their status under Oregon water law. And so I guess my quick read is that they are very able players in this whole process.
Thank you.
The other thing I need to note about the adjudication is that this is an area that the governor chose to invest additional resources in our budget. So historically, our budget's been about $600,000 a biennium in this area. That's round numbers. The governor, we've actually been spending quite a bit more than that, and frankly finding savings in other programs to do that because we felt it so important to keep this process moving. The governor's budget recognizes our actual spending levels along these lines and attempts to provide resources along that line for us to fulfill this responsibility. Any further questions there, Mr. Chair? We doing okay?
I can move along.
Okay. The next piece of the equation in terms of what you've asked us to provide is a discussion of how we prioritize our programs. And so here are the criteria that we used. Frankly, we attempted to meld our, as you can imagine we would, how we prioritized our program with the governor's principles. You can see them articulated up there. And certainly we prioritized them on the basis of the mandates that we are required to fulfill. And then things that we consider core functions and things that actually we can demonstrate results for. So as we prioritize our program, these are the things that we kept in mind. Why don't you go ahead, Debbie, and we'll hit the...
Go ahead.
Sure. Just for curiosity's sake, can you provide us with a list of the governor's principles that they asked you to prioritize with?
Certainly. I think you see several of them articulated up there.
Okay.
And then as we worked through the original smart budgeting process, there were a number of principles that the governor provided. I can make sure we're getting you a complete list, and we'd be happy to do that.
Thank you.
Couple other things along this line. Again, we tried to keep in mind the core functions of the agency: protect existing water rights, facilitate water supply solutions, increase our understanding of the resource, facilitate voluntary stream flow restoration, and provide good data. And this information is actually found, let me see, page 14A in your blue book, should you choose to go there, is where this is all articulated in detail. But we're going to have our basic prioritization stuff up here on the screen, so you're welcome to follow along either way. Here is how we prioritized our programs. We gathered the people you see in the room with us today, our division administrators and key policy staff, at a ritzy resort for a day. It was actually my living room, and we had an expensive catered lunch. It was a wonderful potluck, and we had muffins baked by Adam Sussman's daughters for a morning snack. And so we sat around together one morning, and actually it drifted into the afternoon before we got out of there, and went about the difficult task of prioritizing our program. This is a tough exercise because there were no dramatic winners in terms of the prioritization list. Our programs are very closely ranked. But it was comforting to me that as we all ranked them separately and then came together to do it, they were the rankings were pretty consistent. The other point I want to make here before we actually talk about the list is the integration of these programs. So we ranked them, but these programs are dependent, and I'm struggling for how to clearly articulate this. These programs are really dependent on one another. For example, the water rights program, which comes in at number two, it depends absolutely on information from our information management program to be able to do its business. The mapping, the data management information that's provided through that group is what supports the water rights program. Similarly, the water distribution program, which is ranked number one, depends very closely on information management as well. Again, mapping, water right data, to be able to conduct the distribution activities that they have to conduct. The adjudication program obviously depends on information management for mapping the claims and the status of those claims. So, again, I guess that's another pitch for why we consider information management a program activity in the agency and critical to our mission, even though it's ranked down there at number seven.
Can I just ask for a clarification? And I don't know, you're probably going to go into a lot more detail during the discussion of the individual budgets, but I'm looking at program areas 5 and 6, and they're ranked 2 and 3 in well construction, inspection, and public safety, and then there's some overlap with well construction inspection. And I'm just curious if one is just focused mainly on individual wells and the other's on groundwater monitoring.
Siebert has cover. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I just wanted to maybe walk you through the form a little bit first. I don't know how many times you've looked at these, just so you can see, you know what you're looking at. In the very first column, that is the department-wide ranking, and that's the page he's referred you to. We also asked each agency to prioritize within their program. So that's the second column. So they, for example, the public safety you see is number 5 agency-wide, and that's number 2 in the technical services program area, and that's what the TS stands for, is technical services. And is that's correct. So then if you look at number 7, in technical services, they were actually ranked information management number 1 in that program area, but when they got together and looked at it department-wide, they decided that the public safety was a higher priority department-wide. That's the first two columns. The third column just gives you the brief description of what program those you fall under. You get a description of the program or activity in column 4. Then you see by fund type what expenditures there are, or what's budgeted in that for each of those program areas. And the total funds are in column 11. 12 is the positions, and then the FTE. And then this column 14, if you see a yes there, that just means that there is a policy option package that was included in the governor's recommended budget that affects that program line. Then the very next column is something we'll talk about later, 15% and 10% reduction of GRB. If an agency was identifying a potential reduction on their 10% cut list, we ask them to put the total funds in that column. And that's just an idea. That'll give you an idea of if they're proposing a cut potentially in that area. The code C, F, S, or D is it a statutory required function? Is it constitutionally required function? Federally required is F, and then D is, I'd have to look it up. I don't remember D. D is debt service, that's right, which you have to pay. Then you'll see the citations. Column 18, I think, is a useful column because that will help meld the discussion on this sheet and then what we're doing with performance measures. You'll see that they have a number of performance measures on the first one, water distribution, identified for this program. But if you go down to program number, or the rank number 5, public safety, there's no identified performance measure for that particular one. And then the last column is just a code that we ask them to do on the primary purpose of the program or activity. Frankly, this is also a placeholder so that if at some point the subcommittee or the joint committee develop some goals or identify some criteria method they want to use to prioritize, then we can use that column as well.
Okay. Mr. Chair, if I might then speak directly to your question. Excellent question. Why do we have well construction showing up in our number five spot in the technical services division, and then in our number six spot and in the field services division? Essentially what you have there is you have the standards development, the general oversight, the enforcement, all resting in the technical services division. But for the most part, the inspection is actually done by folks that reside in our field offices. And it's simply a matter of program efficiency. It would be silly for us to have a whole special corps of well inspectors sitting in Salem running out to wherever a well's being drilled around the state when we've got staff in every part of the state that are part of the field services division that can function under the standards and guidance of the technical folks that actually oversee the program.
Make sure there wasn't. I'm sure there was a good explanation, so it didn't look like it was overlap.
So you can see, with your permission, Mr. Chair, we'll just trip through some of these things. Water distribution came up number one on everybody's book. The basic activity of this agency, that's our water masters, us making sure that that nobody is using the first two water masters, as my predecessor used to articulate, guys named Smith and Wesson, to solve their water disputes. Water distribution, making sure that I get the water I'm supposed to get according to my right. Second, the water rights program. You will remember, many of you will, that some years ago this agency came under some pretty significant criticism for its water right backlog. We are now pretty much current.
Yes, Mr. French?
On water right applications in this agency, and so that's due to the good work of folks who preceded me and these folks in this room. But that program is currently current, even given the reduced staffing we've experienced, and we hope to keep it so. The adjudication program is not just the Klamath Basin. Ultimately, we are going to have to adjudicate all groundwater rights in this state, and that process has not even begun. While most surface water is adjudicated in Oregon, we haven't begun that process with groundwater rights. And you cannot certificate a claim, a permit,
until it's adjudicated, correct?
In an adjudication.
Yes. And so that's more than just the Klamath Basin, really, was the point I wanted to make there. Water right changes, a critical program economically in the state right now. I need to move water from point A to point B, or I need to secure water that Senator Shields no longer has a beneficial use for, and we need to transfer it from him to me. This program is the source of our largest workload today, and indeed we have a significant backload in that program, a backload that's been lessened by some authorities you gave us last session to institute some additional fees and hire a couple limited duration positions, and we're going to be asking you to continue those positions. So we have eaten into that backload significantly, but again, a critical program and one that we still need to pay. We need to pay a lot of attention to getting rid of the backload in. Number five, public safety and enforcement. Again, it's a matter of degrees here. We certainly public safety is extremely important to what we do, and the enforcement piece of the agency is an important component of that. Well construction inspection, the actual inspection work, and again we talked about the differentiation just a moment before on that. Then our information management program, I've already probably beat into the ground how important we feel like that is to the functioning of the other programs. And then our surface water and groundwater investigation work. We feel like it's impossible to manage water effectively if you don't know the status of the resource. And this is an area where we begin to see, both these last two areas, begin to see some significant reductions in the governor's recommended budget. Let's go to the next page. Okay, so we're moving down to kind of the last half of our prioritization ranking. Again, these are programs that we consider critical to the functioning of this agency. But our hydrographic data collection, this is stream flow data that we collect around the state. So it came in at number 9, but again, to manage the resource, you've got to know what the status of that resource is. This is part of the collection process for that data. The Water Resources Commission came in at number 10. I hope you'll not share that with the commissioners, that we had them down at number 10. But again, an extremely important part of how we do business. Oregon utilizes government with a board and commission system. And our commission is the rulemaking authority in this agency, and they make some pretty tough decisions on contested cases and other matters. We had a real significant one last commission meeting, and I was frankly very impressed with the manner in which our commission approached that tough decision and believe they made the right call on it. Policy and legal coordination. I think I mentioned earlier that we have a significant legal bill in this agency, a significant legal budget. We get regular visits from the Attorney General because we're such a good customer. So that's an important part of what we do. But again, we had to rank it somewhere. Citizen response, public information. We have a couple folks, one of which the governor's office the governor's budget eliminates that respond to citizen requests for information. And so that came in at 12. Our customer service group is in that category. Water supply and conservation. I guess I'd spend a minute on number 15 there, intergovernmental coordination. And it makes the last three in our list. But again, I don't want to imply that this is not an important element of what this agency does. What the primary responsibility of the individual in this position is to work through tribal water claim issues. And we've been involved in several big settlements regarding tribal water right claims in recent years. The Warm Springs, we settled successfully a few years ago. The Umatilla tribal claims are currently on the table. And so this is something that, frankly, we spend a lot of time on. These last two programs, I'd mention quickly, neither have general fund resources any longer as a part of their portfolio. Number 16 is the hydroelectric program, and this is a program that is operated with about $400,000, a little less than $400,000 in fees from folks who are proposing to have their hydroelectric facilities licensed or relicensed. Yes, sir.
You work with FERC on that. What's your role compared to theirs, and how do you bring in environmental issues that have changed over time when you go to do it?
Mr. Chair, this program provides the state's voice into the FERC licensing process for FERC-licensed facilities. So when there's a FERC-licensed facilities, there's obviously a federal process that is undertaken. But what our program does is it provides the state's voice into that program. So the licensees provide us fees that actually, most of them leave our agency. We only keep about 20% of those fees. Most of them go to ODF&W or to DEQ to support their technical review of the license issues. So this is the state's entree point into those federal programs. The last program there, the Water Development Loan Program, is actually a program that was established constitutionally in the Oregon Water Resources Department many years ago. Currently, and essentially it was to provide money for large water development projects, some of the historic projects with irrigation districts around the state were supported by this program. There are only a half dozen or so loans remaining in that program. And the governor's recommended budget zeroes out the last bit of state general fund. It's about $275,000 that was used to support this program. So that's, again, a program with limited general fund resources.
Well, if it's constitutional, I mean, does it sunset, or are you just going to zero it out or transfer it? And the other is, you know, I'm pretty familiar with the state revolving loan fund that we have through DEQ for water treatment, and this is my whole thing about, you know, we have one agency completely dedicated to water quantity and another to water quality. Are there options for folks, if we zero that out, to use the state revolving loan fund for water development or reuse or, you know, other, because I'm also always looking for other options for that.
Excellent question. And I think the short answer is the reason that the Water Development Loan Fund has been used so sparingly in recent years is that we have not been competitive with the private lending sector in this manner. And the day of perhaps giant development projects along this line that were pretty speculative in nature are gone. So what we're seeing is smaller, targeted development projects that are being handled by the private sector. And so because this is in the Constitution, I don't see the authority for this program ever going away. The day may arise when we no longer have a loan portfolio, and so the program is simply inactive. Again, the program has had a contribution of general fund in it since the mid-80s, I think, when there were some significant issues with the program financially. It was not carrying its own weight. That has been slowly whittled away in the last few biennia, and currently the program is solvent based on the fees associated with it.
And just to follow up, the second part is the state revolving loan fund. Is that strictly right now statutorily limited to water quality projects? Do you know?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm not aware.
Tom's shaking his head. Well, that's DEQ. Because I'm curious about if this is going to zero out, maybe expanding that statutorily to also have water development projects or low-impact hydro or, you know, smaller projects that could qualify for loans, water reuse. Tom knows because he was on my task force. So
certainly a possibility.
I'll do my own research on that, but thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So, Mr. Chair, I guess I'd ask at this point, are there any further questions on the prioritization exercise?
Well, for me, Mr. Siebert, do you have any other questions on it?
Just a clarification for the committee. If you look on the sheets that are in your book, you'll see the last three are just at the bottom, and they're not ranked. And these are core administrative functions. They have the fiscal accounting and budgeting, the human resources, and the support services. And so the agency has listed those for you, but obviously all the other programs are dependent on these services. And I would also point out maybe that you'll see something unique in this agency, as they've already described. They moved their information technology, information systems down into the program level. And in other agencies you see, you very well might see a line that's not prioritized that is information technology because of, as the director was talking about, the interdependence on all the other programs. That's one of the reasons why we allowed agencies, if they wanted to list the administrative functions, but not prioritize them, because they're required to do any kind of work at all. Thank you. Well, I just also, as a point of clarification, I think it was when we were covering number 11, the policy legal coordination. I believe the director said that that's where a lot of the legal costs are. I just would also point out that in the adjudication number 3, there's some legal costs there for the Klamath adjudication. That's where the bulk of the legal costs that the governor added show up in the program. So just so you don't think that the only legal expenses are the $800,000 in that program.
I have a question for you. Is there any way we can recover those costs?
For
the adjudication, I mean, I think I've asked before about federal funding for that.
Mr. Chair.
Smile. They're all laughing back there.
Well,
but
this is rather a sore point, Mr. Chair, Representative, because, and it's frankly, it's a sore point with the private parties that are participating in the adjudication who have to pay fairly significant fees and who have to support their own legal costs. The courts found that the federal government originally asserted legally that it did not have to participate in the adjudication, that it just could assert its Federal Reserve claims, and we'd get to acquiesce to that. We won that battle in the court. Courts found that they were subject to Oregon's adjudication laws, but they also found as part of that that they were not responsible to pay any fees as a part of that process. So the fees that our private sector folks in Klamath County are paying to participate in the adjudication, the federal government is not subject to. We'd be delighted to recover some of those costs, Representative, if the courts would allow us.
That's a lot of money.
Mr. Chair, I think the next place, and I guess I'll just ask you if you want to go ahead and launch into this piece today or if you want to wait till Monday, but we're to the performance measures part, which is the last real significant piece of our presentation.
What is your
We've got the reductions as well, too.
There was a time frame on that all. By the time you get done with your performance measures and your reductions.
If we just go to the reductions
now. Yeah. Yeah, let's do the reductions now so that we get more of the committee here. By Monday, we'll probably have our little chair thing straightened around, and we can go.
Yes.
Better to have that person here then.
So we're going to skip to the reductions piece. Let's see if I can find it here. And in the presentation, those pages aren't numbered, so
that's a no-no.
Yeah.
I think these are numbered. It would be toward on page 15, I believe it is, of the handout.
So second to the last page.
Yeah. Second to the last page, the middle slide, governor's investments and reductions, is where you're going to start it.
So these are the puts and takes, Mr. Chair, in the governor's budget. Relative to this agency. So we'll start with the additions, the investments that the governor has made in our budget in terms of general fund and then other fund as well. The governor chose to invest a significant amount of new money in the Klamath adjudication. And again, I think the intent was there to bring us to an amount of funding that would allow us to complete this adjudication in a timely fashion. Secondly, the governor's budget also provides some other fund position authority, particularly in the transfers program. It continues 3 limited duration positions that you all established last session in this program. Again, other fund funded, so they're funded with fee revenue. Fees that come in to do transfers, but it just gives us some positions on a limited duration business or basis to get the job done. Reduce that backlog. The last thing, and again something that we're very hopeful that you all will reauthorize or remove the sunset from, is the receipts authority or reimbursement authority program. The governor's budget asks you to remove the sunset from that program and to provide us a half of a limited duration FTE to manage it. So we've gotten to the point with this program, there's enough business in this program that we actually need somebody to coordinate it. And so we're asking for half of a position based on fees. The reductions are on the right-hand side.
What are the dollars involved with the receipts authority and the
see, I brought a page with that on it, Mr. Chair. Let me see if I can lay my hand on it.
Do
you have that with you, Deb?
Mr. Chair, member of the committee, I believe the package totals just slightly under 300,000 other funds. And that's total limitation. Just some part of that, I believe, would be for the position itself. Some of that limitation is to allow the agency to expend the monies that come in for the contracted services. That sounds about right.
Yes, that sounded real good. And, Mr. Chair, we'd be happy to detail that further for you in writing. I have that. I have a little cheat sheet on that. Yes. So there's a slide on that back in our performance measures piece. Let's see if we can find that real quick.
You're probably going to ask when we get into the actual budget presentation. Other people are here that want to know what's going on.
Here's some kind of interesting vital statistics on the Receipts Authority program. Done 22 certificates, 10 extensions, 32 transfers. These are contracts. Some of these are completed, some aren't. So 30, 40, over 60 contracts we've entered into since this program, this very young program, was initiated. The cost range for the people who are paying to get this done, between $630 and $1,400. So a transfer would be the $1,400 version, and perhaps a certificate, getting the final work done for on a certificate at the lower level. Been a, again, I can't remember, Adam, when did we get that program actually up and running?
It started in March of 2004.
So we actually got it running March a year ago, so less than a year ago, and we've already had that much business. Good thing that's done is it's made the line shorter for both the people who've paid and the people who haven't.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I believe the position cost of that $300,000 would be just slightly under $70,000 for the biennium. Are the position costs for the half FTE. Again, the rest would be for the contracted services. And Mr. Ward, maybe you could explain a little bit of how that position gets funded in this whole mix, because the people are paying the actual cost, the contractor costs. So how does the position get funded in the package?
Ultimately, we'll end up, Mr. Chair and Mr. Siebert, ultimately we'll end up, I think, increasing our base fees in this program to fund this half a position. And frankly, I don't think we'll get a bit of fussing out of our customers on that, because they felt like they've gotten a pretty good deal to this point. But ultimately, the fees will have to bear the weight of that. So in terms of the reduction side, as you can see, a little over $1 million there in general fund. 7.5 FTE. 6.5 of these are currently filled positions.
Not going to go away from attrition.
Mr. Chair, we may have some attrition between now and then. We may have some other positions open up that folks can slide into before we actually have to do the layoffs. I would anticipate, however, that that this will mean some actual existing filled position layoffs before we're done. And currently today it's 6.5 filled positions. And as you can see, things from one of our reception persons, who obviously they don't make the top of the program rankings, but they're pretty important to how you do business. One of our customer service people, that's one of our front counter people that serves the public when they come in to ask water right questions. We're losing a computer programmer. Policy position that was associated with the director's office is going away. One of our water rights certificates persons, so an individual that actually puts the final water rights certificates together, we're losing one of those folks, and The rationale behind that was a lot of the work folks can actually pay for a certified water rights examiner to do, and so if they want to get their certificate quickly, they can use the reimbursement authority process to do that. One, a support staff in the water rights division, and then an individual that's involved in our water use measurement and reporting program. So those are the positions that are going away. We're also losing the last $200,000 in our groundwater study money. This program at one time had about $600,000 of biennium in it. It's the methodology we use to conduct some of the groundwater studies that we talked about earlier in the day. And this now zeroes that program out. So there was $200,000 left in that program. That's now zeroed out.
Tell us how you think that's going to affect us, that $200,000 right there.
Well, the challenge for us will be, for example, in the Umatilla Basin, we're currently, we frankly have a commitment from, I think a pretty solid commitment from the federal government to participate with us on a 50-50 basis in the Umatilla Basin groundwater study. What we'll have to do is, rather than not having state general fund to match that, we'll have to find, local partners who will help fund programs of this nature for us to continue them. So there will be an impact. I don't think there's any question about that fact.
A follow-up to that, Mr. Chair, is I guess you could go up and say what's the impact going to be with the reduction of 7.5 FTEs, and you mentioned before that you were current on water rights applications. So the question is, because does that mean you're not going to be issuing as many certificates? I mean, are you going to be shifting over to more of the receipts authority? So basically, if people can afford to pay, are going to get the service more? I guess, and maybe I'll learn more as we go through it, and that's a question looking at that I have.
Well, I think, it'd be disingenuous of me to imply that we would be able to do everything at the same level and same rate that we can today without these positions. Kind of, I think what you see here is kind of a trickle-down effect. Several of these positions are in the water rights division. And so if you take a receptionist and one of the customer service people out of that program, then what you end up doing is having other technical staff who are working on water rights certificates or working on water right applications, permit applications, and you bring them to the front counter to deal with the issues that the public raise when they show up, because obviously you can't ignore the public that walk in your door, and so you end up having frankly more highly paid folks do work that might be a little below their pay grade. That said, we've put a strategy together to deal with it, but it will have an impact on the certificates, the water rights certificates. Again, that's something that some of the work can be done by the private sector if folks are willing to pay for that. And so that's one reason why that position was selected. The individual in that particular position is actually a long-term employee and will probably bump into another position when his goes away. But these cuts, obviously we're not a large staffed agency to begin with, so they will have an impact on us. Again, we believe we've put a plan together to be able to address that. The last piece there, the cash infusion to the loan program, this is the last remaining piece of cash contribution to that program we talked about earlier. Again, we believe that the program is solvent at the current time in its current status, and so it can survive that reduction. Now, Mr. Chair, we can move to the next piece of the reduction piece, the additional 10% that you all ask us to identify.
Yes.
If that's all right with you, and that's the next page of your, it's in tab 4 of the book, of the blue book, and we'll also articulate the general information up here on the screen. but the pull-out folders there, or the pull-out sheets there in tab 4. So you ask us to identify an additional 10%, and the spreadsheet in your notebook shows the options for each fund type. We're going to talk through here the general fund reductions that we identified, since they're probably the things of most interest to you all. And again, we use the same criteria for our reduction options as we did to prioritize our programs. You saw that slide earlier in the day. But we wanted to make sure we'd be able to fulfill our mandates, meet the governor's principles, meet our core functions, and retain programs that had demonstrated results. Oh, I don't want to go there yet. Sorry. So you can see the additional 10% right there. A position in our water right changes program, again, that would affect the transfers that we talked about earlier. A position in our water supply and conservation program, again, this is an effort involved in reviewing water supply and conservation plans, and so we're seeing a reduction there. Policy legal reduction, that's an additional reduction in the director's office. Hydrographic data collection, this is a person who takes all the data we get in from the field and puts it into something we can understand and use in Salem. So it removes a position there, but it also removes the field folks who are actually collecting that data. So that's over five positions there.
What do you lose by not having the data as far as the future? How's it going to affect you or the public?
Well, ultimately, Mr. Chair, this is something that's frankly of extreme concern to our staff, because you don't make informed and accurate decisions on management of the water resource unless you have the data to support those. And so this would frankly cripple pretty significantly the information gathering process that we use to make decisions in terms of allocating water, new water rights around the state, allowing transfers in different spots.
You know, Mr. Chair, I appreciate your comment, because it sounds to me like, you know, you're getting lost looking into the future, so you just decided to throw away the map. You know, that's a scary, scary prospect.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I don't. I think there's some. We begin to lose the map with these kind of reductions, and frankly, it's a choice between lesser evils as we've moved through this reduction process. I'm not enthusiastic about any of these reductions, because they will impact the agency's ability to serve its customers.
Just a thought, Mr. Chair. I can remember several years ago going to the Schnitz, and Mikhail Gorbachev spoke on water.
They got it in Russia, too.
And, yeah, and he made the comment that water would be to the 21st century what oil was to the 20th century. Mm. The biggest battle there is, you know, that'll be water.
There it is.
And it is. And yet, it seems to me that if we're all doing what we're doing in Oregon, and I imagine 50 states and most of the countries are all kind of doing it too much in isolation from one another, too much in a myopic kind of silo way, that we are creating we talk about forest fires here, you know, in the water sense of things, we're creating a different kind of conflagration. I realize I'm new to the arena, the new kid on the block, but looking at it from kind of maybe a fresh perspective, this is very scary to me. The whole thing.
You're trying to manage something without information to use as the foundation of your decision making, and if you don't have it, then what do we got when you come in here?
Mr. Chair, members, it could certainly lessen the integrity of our decision-making process there at Water Resources, and that's why certainly it would be our hope that you not avail yourself of the option to take these this additional 10%, because we believe the impact would be significant. A further indicator there, the surface groundwater investigation, a significant reduction there includes 3 FTE. This is essentially our groundwater staff, and these are the folks that make the decisions. They make a call on every water right application that comes in the door for the use of groundwater as to whether water is available and as to whether allowing a water right would injure another water right holder. And so that's reducing that staff. What's your total staff there, Barry? Okay, so that's significantly reducing that staff area.
8 to 5.
Mr. Siever, in the process of the co-chairs and the chair of this committee, and they look specifically at a particular line item in the budget like that one in a program, we can work and suggest that maybe that not be reduced to that degree. Is that right? Work with the co-chairs?
Mr. Chair, absolutely.
And so this isn't in blood. We may say that is a higher priority than somewhere else. And that's where the big choices are, and the tough choices will have to be made in the future here over the next several months.
And Mr. Chair, if I might add, one of the difficulties with this department is they are very unique to natural resource agencies in that two-thirds of their budget is general fund. So when they have to identify 10% cuts, they have to identify a significant portion of their programs that would, in essence, be put on the chopping block. Mm-hmm. And if I'm not mistaken, in the governor's budget, they are one of the few, if not the only, natural resource agency that has actual positions that are being eliminated.
Well, that's going to cause some real discussion, I think, in the future. And we need to talk about it. We're going to have our permanent chair is going to be here in the very near future, and then we can make sure you express your concerns and see what she says. So go ahead, Phil.
Okay, Mr. Chair, the last item there is two more positions out of our information management program. And again, I've spent a long time today boring you with how important we feel like that program is to the success of the rest of our operation. So I won't rearticulate that. But again, These cuts, in a general sense, represent a very, very severe impact on the agency.
I have a question because I'm new to this, the Ways and Means process, and this may be a naive question. And I think about your point. I mean, I have worked with pretty much all the 14 different natural resource agencies in one time or another, and mainly through professional work. And I guess the question I have is, do we have any type of formula? It seems like every agency has a different proportion of their funds, coming from fees versus general fund. And I guess trying to think about this logically, do we have any type of formula, or do we look at the different services and say, okay, this, for instance, water right adjudication, it's going to benefit a certain user, and so we mainly pay that through fees versus other services that really are for the good of the entire population that we should fund through general fund? And do you do any type of analysis of that when you're doing your budgeting? And I don't know, maybe that's a naive question, but I'm just curious, especially since each agency has a different proportion.
Mr. Chair, I think that part of it is policy choices that have been made over the years in the legislature. And one of the policy choices in this arena, and this is the first time I've done this budget, but it seems to me that historically people have looked at this as a state resource that the state should bear the burden of paying I don't want to say regulate necessarily, but that's what it is. And other choices have been made in other areas that have shifted the burden more onto fee payers, and that hasn't occurred as much in this department.
And I'm not necessarily advocating for that. I'm just saying I would think that would be a useful part of the discussion in talking about your budget, and have you, in prioritizing in that list, looked at sort of, what is for the common good versus individuals. And we could all say that water is to the benefit of everybody, and you can't really to say, okay, you should pay for it because it's your well, when it affects your neighbor who's using the same aquifer.
This is general fund dollars.
Yes.
So we're going to have to go to a little pie chart. And if we're going to put that back, where the rest of the pie do you want to take it? We're all going to have the pleasure doing that. And that's where it gets tough.
So I guess that's more of a philosophical question than I threw out there.
And Mr. Chair, Representative, having served in two different state agencies and one with a greater proportion of other funds, certainly in these times you're thankful for that when you're there. But I know on a philosophy basis, when I was at ODA, at one time the food safety program there was 50-50 general fund fee support. Currently, I think that's pretty close to 100% fee support. So I think there were definite philosophical underpinnings in the construction of these budgets many years ago. Those get challenged as we face the kind of fiscal times that we're currently in.
Okay, we've got about 11-12 minutes. Just see how much we can get through here.
Well, I've got one more slide I'd just like to talk about in terms of summarizing the issues that we talked about today. And then the only other thing that would be on our presentation list would be the performance measure piece that we jumped over already today.
Well,
so
if we can finish this up, let's do that tomorrow.
So just a couple summary points. Again, we felt like there were significant reductions to our budget in the governor's recommended budget, and we've articulated those with you all today. The other point that the programs are integrated, and these are certainly, I know I've spent a fair amount of time hammering on that issue today, but we really do want you to understand that our programs build upon each other, and it's very difficult, with the exception of a couple of those programs on the bottom end of that priority list, to take one of them out and not impact the others above that program on the list. Thirdly, I'd say I'd say this without unabashedly, Mr. Chair, that we feel like this agency is the work it does is essential to the economic and environmental health of the state, and that what we do has a significant impact both on the economic equation and people's ability to successfully do business using the natural resources of the state and the environmental protections that we all hold so dear here in Oregon. And then finally, I'll just reiterate one more time that there is no federal counterpart or backstop for these activities. And again, it would be our view that in Oregon we don't want the federal government involved in the allocation of our waters. We believe that's a state resource, Mr. Chair. So that would conclude my prepared remarks.
Committee members, do you have any other questions or comments you want to make?
I asked him how he feels about the UN regulating our water, but that's just a joke.
That was fine words.
Mr. Siebert, what do we have Monday?
Mr. Chair, Monday we'll be back in here at 1 o'clock, continuing with the Water Resources Department, and they'll be going through their performance measures.
Okay. And we'll be prepared with those for you Monday morning or Monday afternoon.
Okay, thank you for your help and your work.
Thank you.
And the committee is adjourned.